Hello, Absurdistanis, and welcome to Absurdistan, the transatlantic political podcast with news and opinion from the absurd political reality which is our home. My name is John.
And my name is Adam.
In this episode, we cover the new populist Italian government and the Irish referendum on abortion that is being voted on today. Both those stories and your weekly look ahead coming up, but first, a bit of housekeeping. Adam?
Thanks to some of the feedback that you've given us, the consensus seems to be that you enjoy our conversations, our back and forth, a little bit more than our weekly reports, which is great. That's really good to know. So in response to that, we've decided to drop the report for this week and pilot a new format of the episode. So we're still going to be covering two stories, but we're going to take a deeper look at one of them. This will allow for a longer conversation and a little bit of a deeper look at the circumstances surrounding this issue. And of course, given that we are Absurdistan, there is yet another controversial topic that we just have to cover, because the absurd world just keeps throwing these at us. It was Iran, and then it was Israel, and now it is, of course, abortion. So controversial topics all over the place. We're going to start with that this week. We're still going to have some reports from time to time, but the plan is to limit these to interviews or other interesting things that come across our path. So when they happen, they'll happen, and we look forward to bringing those to you. But now we're just going to get straight to the episode. So we have two basic stories for you, one out of Italy and one out of Ireland. So John, I know that you wanted to start in Italy.
That's right. We have an interesting situation developing there. On December 28th of 2017, Italian President Sergio Mattarella dissolved the country's parliament. Now, the Italian parliament, like most parliaments, consists of two houses, the Chamber of Deputies and the Senate. The Chamber of Deputies has 630 seats. The candidates for the chamber are elected by anyone over the age 18. There's universal suffrage in Italy, and this actually includes constituencies that are living abroad. 12 seats in the Chamber of Deputies are voted on by constituencies abroad. The Senate consists of 315 seats. The candidates for the Senate are voted on by anyone over the age of 25. And also, some seats are voted on by constituencies abroad. The Senate also has senators for life, which include former presidents and up to five citizens that can be appointed by the president for, quote, bringing honor to the nation through their achievements. So that's kind of interesting. Just a regular citizen can be appointed to the Senate.
I came across one of them recently, actually.
You did?
Yeah, it was a guy named Bobbio. He wrote one of the readings for my course last week, actually. I forget what he did, though.
So now that we understand how that's laid out, there's 630 seats in the lower house, 315 seats in the upper house, and then that's overseen by the executive branch, which is the president. What's unique about the Italian system, which is slightly different than other parliamentary systems, is that the president plays a much more hands-on role in forming the government. Many times in parliamentary democracies, the coalition that has the majority of the seats or the party that has the majority of the seats, the leader of that party is automatically prime minister and they form a government. In the Italian system, the president actually has to appoint one of the leaders or a member of the parties with the largest number of seats. And then the president gives that individual a mandate to form a government. That individual then appoints different people from within the party to become the ministers, which will run the various aspects of the government. But after those appointments are made, the president then also has to sign off on these appointments and essentially give his blessing to the government. So if a mandate is given to somebody, to a prime minister, and they go and collect the government of ministers that the president is not in favor of, he can actually dissolve that government and either give them a new mandate or he can give the mandate to somebody else.
Italy is actually quite interesting because it does have a ceremonial presidency, but it's not ceremonial in the way that Iceland or Ireland are, in which they're essentially this just there as signatories to bills. But they're not like the French presidents either, who wield significant political power. So they're kind of this weird in-between zone that they're only effective or they're only non-ceremonial really when new governments are being formed. And Italy is just so, you know, crazy at the moment politically that the president has actually had to play a more significant role than normal.
That's right. So this general election took place on March 4th. And as we've seen with many parliamentary democracies, particularly in the Netherlands recently, it can take a while before a government is actually formed. There's a lot of negotiation that has to happen, especially when no parties or coalitions have an outright majority that would allow them to run the government. So these negotiations for the Italian government took about 90 days.
Which is actually fairly short, given some of the other elections that have happened recently in European countries. I think it took longer than that for the Germans. I think the Dutch took about 260 days. Yeah, 90 days isn't bad.
It is relatively short, but I think that's because, as we'll see, the vote was really only split between three different sects. There were two coalitions and one party. The other smaller parties didn't really garner that many votes. So, for instance, in some place like the Netherlands that has an incredible amount of parties and different factions that won't build coalitions together that don't have similar policy goals, a lot of times what you see in those countries is it takes months upon months to negotiate a deal, and you have to go into the minutiae of, well, what particular policies of our platform are you willing to put into effect if we become part of your coalition? Mm. And so there's a lot of negotiation that has to happen in that case. In this case, as you will see, the two players were really only two parties, essentially. Going into the election, we only had three factions that would have garnered the most votes. The first coalition is the center-right coalition, which consists of four parties, but most notably two parties, the League, led by Matteo Salvini, and the Forza Italia, which is led by former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, which, if you remember anything about him, he's quite the controversial figure. Both these parties are highly populist. The League can be characterized as a nationalistic, regionalist party, and they are very Eurosceptic. The Forza Italia is also populist, a little bit less Eurosceptic, but they support, interestingly enough, closer relationships with Russia, and they're definitely in favor of reducing sanctions against Russia and actually trying to build closer diplomatic ties between the two countries.
Berlusconi and Putin are cut from the same cloth. Like, Berlusconi is an oligarch, essentially. He would fit right into the Russian scene.
The second coalition is the center-left coalition, which consists of five parties, but really there's only one party that's worth mentioning, the Democratic Party, led by Matteo Renzi. They garnered the most votes out of any party in this coalition by millions. So I believe that the Democratic Party had over 6 million votes, and the second largest party in the coalition only got about 800,000 votes. So this coalition is really built around the Democratic Party, and this party can be characterized as essentially a social democratic party, very center-left. They emerged out of the post-communist parties in Italy. Actually, a little bit of interesting trivia. Their symbol used to be the hammer and sickle, but in recent years, they actually changed it to the red rose of European social democracy. Pretty much down the line in the middle, social democracy, something that you'd see out of like the Christian Democrats in Germany.
It should be noted as well that Matteo Renzi is actually the former prime minister, and he was trying to aim his campaign, angle his campaign in the same way as Macron did. So he was the one trying to appeal to the broad centre. So even though he was a democratic leader, he was very much in line with Macron, and he was Europe's favourite to win.
That's right, he was. He was the most Europe-friendly or EU-friendly of the candidates. And surprisingly, the third major player was not a coalition at all, but rather one single party called the Five Star Movement, led by Luigi Di Maio. This party received the most votes out of any party on the ballot by far. They got more than 10 million votes, compared to around 6 million for both the League and the Democratic Party. This party was started in 2009 by a comedian and blogger and a web strategist. They're considered populist, anti-establishment, Euroskeptic, environmentalists. They advocate for direct democracy and anti-interventionism. And it's also very much web-based. A lot of the in-party votes that they do are completely online. So very modern, only founded in 2009. Essentially what they want to do is fight for the interests of the everyday average Italian person rather than the elites. So very populist, very anti-establishment, and they blew every other party out of the water as far as it comes to votes, which is incredibly interesting. In the Chamber of Deputies, the center-right coalition ended up with 265 seats out of a 630-seat House. The center-left coalition only got 122 seats, which was a net loss of 223 seats, with 180 of those alone coming from the Democratic Party. The Five Star Movement, a single party, not a coalition, got 227 seats in the Chamber of Deputies, which is a massive amount of seats to hold for one party in a multi-party system.
Mm-hmm.
In the Senate, the center-right coalition ended up with 137 seats. The center-left coalition only got 60 seats, which was a net loss of 63 seats, so they lost more than half of their own seats. And the Five Star Movement got 112 seats, which again, for one party in a multi-party system, that's a huge chunk of the seats in the legislatures. after the election, both the leaders of the center-right coalition and the Five Star Movement said that they should be given the prime ministership by the president, along with a mandate to form a government, because their coalition and party, respectively, had secured the largest numbers of votes and seats, which is reasonable. Each party had about a third of the seats in a legislature in a multi-party system, which is not easy to do. After two exploratory mandates that failed, essentially the president gave a mandate to an individual and they were unable to form a government. After those failed, the Five Star Movement and the League, who had previously said they wouldn't be willing to form a coalition, began negotiating to form a governing program. After several weeks of negotiations on May 21st, both parties recommended Giuseppe Conte as the new prime minister. And on May 23rd, Conte was granted the task of forming a new government by President Mattarella. And he now has the task of forming a government and appointing ministers that the president will ultimately have to approve. And this is incredibly interesting because Conte is not a politician. In fact, he has no political experience at all to speak of. He's a relatively unknown law professor who was picked out by the leader of the League, Matteo Salvini, and the leader of the Five Star Movement, Luigi Di Maio, as sort of a middle ground between the two parties that would not only be able to secure the support of the president, but somebody who effectively is going to be a puppet of the two parties that put him in power. Because really, he has no political experience. He doesn't have any clout, and he's suddenly going to be the head of the government for the country, which is incredible. It's a meteoric rise for a nobody, and he's going to be, more than likely, he's going to be the prime minister of Italy. Now, what makes this interesting is that the governing program agreed upon by the League and the Five Star Movement can almost be described as an Italy First program. They are focused on reducing immigration. Italy has had a big problem with illegal immigration after the fall of Gaddafi in Libya, actually. They've had a huge surge in illegal immigration of people coming across the Mediterranean on boats. And this has caused a political crisis, really, for particularly the Democratic Party. This election can almost be seen as just a repudiation of Matteo Renzi's policies of the Democratic Party being pro-immigration and not really doing a whole lot to stop this surge that people are seeing as a big, big problem. So the new government's focus is going to be on restricting immigration, reducing public debt. I believe that Italy has the highest public debt in Europe, just behind Greece. The government will also focus on Euroscepticism as well. So definitely not a result that the European Union was looking for. And this is significant because Italy is the third largest economy in the Eurozone. And in the wake of something like Brexit and the rise of Euroscepticism in places like France, Germany, other countries abroad, the Netherlands, I'm wondering, Adam, do you think that this signals the beginning of the end for the EU?
It's certainly another data point on a long trajectory of the EU. I'm not sure if it's another step or the beginning of the downfall of the EU. I'm not even sure if the current or the new government will be necessarily anti-EU so much as it will be anti-Eurozone. So in other words, I wonder if they're particularly against the financial union versus the market. Because to take Italy out of the biggest market in the world is as ridiculous as taking the UK out of the biggest market in the world. I don't think there's any desire to do that. But I think what Renzi represented was this, again, it's the same narratives that you are hearing in these other countries, that it's the global elite, it's the finance, that the regular people of Italy are being left behind. And so you have these groups coming in to say, no, we will look after your interests. We will stand up to the big, bad, neoliberal European Union. And it's an effective message because on the ground, the employment rate in Italy is terrible. You're right, public debt looks atrocious. The management of public funds is ridiculously terrible. And so when you have two groups, particularly two outside groups, saying these parties, these people have done you no good over there, running government, you need to try something else. That's a message that sticks. And that is effectively the populist message. It's the real people against the elites. That's a strong platform to be running on, and it worked for them, particularly for the Five Star Movement. But the Lega, the League, is also a populist movement. These guys are really interesting. These guys are kind of in my zone, in my area of study, because they're a nationalist party as well initially. And so it's really funny to see a nationalist party in government, in national government now. The platform that these two parties have been able to put together, though, have been really interesting, because what you have represented in both parties is effectively a left-wing populist party in the Five Star Movement and a right-wing populist party in the League. So what on earth does a policy platform, a government platform, actually look like when two of these groups come together? Obviously, there has been a lot of negotiation as to what policies should be included, but one of the really interesting ones that goes back to an episode of ours recently, John, is they're going to try, or at least it's in the government platform, universal basic income for an area of the country, particularly the South, which is very funny because the League are, like I said, a nationalist party for the North, which is the wealthy region of the country. And they want to split from the rest of Italy, or used to want to split from the rest of Italy, because they thought that the South was taking all of the North's money and spending it on themselves, and effectively that all the tax money was leaving the North and going into the South. So it's really funny that you now have the League, the party that stood against this for years to the point of secession, then agreeing to a policy platform like this. So that kind of gives me an inkling to say that maybe this coalition isn't long for the world. I don't know how they are able to put that past their supporters. We'll see what happens.
That seems to be a theme, though, among parliamentary systems, where in order to form a government and actually implement the policies that you find to be most important, you have to give on some pretty important things. I mean, we even saw that in the UK after their election, their disastrous snap election that Theresa May called, where they had to make massive concessions to the DUP to form a government that was stable enough to govern.
There are red lines that just won't be crossed, though. So, for instance, you won't see the Conservatives and Labour forming a coalition in the UK at any point. And I'm really surprised that these two groups in particular were able to get together. They are united in philosophy, though. This idea of anti-establishment, anti-elite, pro-people, populist, so that unites them. But can that actually unite a government platform? Can you run a welfare system on it? Can you tax when one party doesn't believe in tax and the other party believes in heavy taxation? Like, how have they agreed? So we don't know the food details yet. We certainly don't know what this government will look like in practice yet because it hasn't technically been formed. I'm all for seeing new experimental ways of governing, and I'm really interested to see how this one turns out.
What I'm most interested by is this phenomenon that we're seeing across the globe of populism becoming mainstream. You can debate how effective that's been, but that was the big pull of the Trump campaign, was that it was anti-establishment, it was for the little guy, it was against the international globalist elite. We saw this in France, we've seen this in Germany, we just talked about this last week in Iraq, where you're having populist parties almost all at once gaining massive traction across the globe. And I think it's something that we need to watch closely. And I think particularly the populist aspect of it, the potential ramifications on the EU, I don't think you could point at a time in history where you've seen a phenomenon like this with so many different countries almost at once reaching the conclusion that, well, what's going on right now isn't working. And we need to revolt against that in this with this populist party. It's fascinating.
This week, I want us to take a look at the Irish abortion referendum that's happening today if you're listening on the 25th. But an obvious disclaimer before we begin. We are very aware that we are both men about to tackle a largely women's issue. Abortion policy is a set of laws that has regulative power over women only. Now, we're both married. We both have kids. We both have experiences with pregnancy, but only vicariously through our wives. We will never experience a crisis pregnancy. We don't have a fear of rape or its repercussions. We'll never be asked to put the life of an unborn baby or fetus before our own, and we will never be shamed for choosing to do otherwise. We will never experience any of this. But for women in Ireland, personal experiences like these being made public have led Irish society to reconsider their constitutional ban on abortion. Irish society is socially conservative, or at least it was. It's beginning to liberalize. It's beginning to become a little bit more progressive as the country, as the particularly the younger people, begin to lose the Catholic heritage that's existed in the island for years. We've seen it manifested in the same-sex marriage referendum that happened in 2015, in which gay marriage was approved. So the fact that progressive issues are coming into the fore and are being dealt with via public referendum is becoming the norm in Irish civil and political life. So what I'm going to do here is I'd like to look back at the history of the abortion context, and particularly why Ireland has decided to look at the gay marriage issue and the abortion issue via referenda, and particularly constitutional referenda. Then we'll take a look at what the campaign has looked like on both sides and what they're arguing just now. And then we'll have a brief short time, oh my goodness, heaven help us, on controversial issues, where we will share a little bit about what we think about the issue. So, John, did you know that it was actually the American courts that began spinning up the Irish debate over abortion?
I didn't know that. I'm assuming following Roe v. Wade or Griswold v. Connecticut?
Yeah, spot on. So what happened in Ireland, this was in the early 1970s. The Supreme Court in both Ireland and the United States seemed to be going through this stage of finding rights in the Constitution that weren't there literally. So finding rights in between the lines. And one of the things that the Supreme Court of Ireland said was a right was the right to marital privacy. Now, after this was decided in the Irish Supreme Court, news from America started filtering through that privacy issues and abortion had been linked in Roe versus Wade. And so there was a little bit of concern about what could happen next in Ireland. Abortion at the time was already illegal. This was the 1970s in a very Catholic country. This was a society that up until the 1960s made contraception illegal. And divorce wasn't legalized, I think, until the 1970s either, which is another interesting thing.
We've seen a similar evolution from social conservatism to social liberalism in the States as well, especially regarding contraceptive issues, marital issues like intermarriage between races, for instance.
Yeah, fair enough.
These are fairly recent developments in the United States. In fact, both of my parents were born before an African-American and a white person could be married legally in the United States. So,
fortunately, that isn't an issue that has to be dealt with in Ireland, but like America, abortion is a big and divisive issue. Taking advantage of political disarray in the early 1980s, there was a lobbying group that wanted a constitutional amendment that would have outlawed, completely banned abortion. So anything that could have been coming in the form of Roe versus Wade would essentially have been nullified. If you can change the constitution, no court can overrule that. Ireland has a really interesting process. So if you're an American, you know that your constitution is difficult to amend.
Oh, absolutely. It's an incredibly difficult and arduous process. It's amazing to me that we've ever actually been able to amend the Constitution after the Bill of Rights.
Ireland, on the other hand, it's a simple, very simple amendment process. It's a simple bill that's passed through the Ríochtas, or the Parliament in Ireland. It's just put forward as a simple bill. If it passes the House, it then goes forward to a public referendum. So you need those two stages. That's why, for instance, the same-sex marriage referendum was a constitutional referendum. The constitution had to be changed in order for it to be made legal. Now, back in 1983, the Eighth Amendment was passed. This was an amendment that outlawed abortion. On 53.67% turnout, 67% voted in favor of banning abortion and added this text to the constitution. So this is what the Constitution says today. The state acknowledges the right to life of the unborn and, with due regard to the equal rights of life of the mother, guarantees in its law to respect and, as far as practicable, by its laws to defend and vindicate that right. So the lobbying group was successful. This was a section of text that was added to the Constitution which led to the complete ban of abortion in the Republic of Ireland. Now, unfortunately, this has legal repercussions. Of course it does. It's the Constitution. And in 1991, a very sad and unfortunate case came before the court system in Ireland. It was a Supreme Court case that involved a 14-year-old victim of rape. Now, she's referred to as X because of her age, and so the case has been known as the X case, or officially Attorney General versus X. The girl fell pregnant after being raped by a neighbour in December 1991. She began developing suicidal thoughts thanks to the unwanted pregnancy, and she began planning a trip to the United Kingdom with her family for an abortion. Now, the family asked the Garda Síochána, which is the police force, if fetal DNA could be admissible as evidence in court, because obviously the assault case had to come before the court. But hearing that X and her family planned a termination, the AG, the Attorney General of Ireland, a guy named Harry Whelan, sought an injunction under the Eighth Amendment to stop the family from leaving the country. And the injunction was granted. It was in the law. It's in the Constitution. You cannot have an abortion. Eventually, there was an appeal to the Supreme Court that was heard in March of 1992. And the Supreme Court found 4-1 in favour that the girl had a right to an abortion under the Eighth Amendment, given that there was a credible threat to her life. Though the ruling upheld the right of abortion, if the life was threatened, it didn't recognise the risk to health. Unfortunately, X miscarried shortly after the ruling, yielding the ruling moot. The good news is that the assailant, Sean O'Brien, was tried and convicted on sexual assault charges, and he ended up spending 6.5 years in prison.
So at least some justice was served.
Justice was served. And in fact, you could argue that more justice than the simple bringing to justice the assailant. Because what happened next was public outrage. You know, the fact that this case, the fact that the state had acted in such a way to endanger a child over the abortion issue. And remember, acting strictly within the rule of the Constitution. There was nothing wrong. There was nothing illegal with it. They were doing their duty, you could say. So public outrage led to one of these bills passing Parliament that would go to public referendum to amend the Constitution. In fact, there were three of them. This was supposed to be the 12th, the 13th and the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. And all three were put to public vote in November 1992. There was a 68% turnout for all three. The 12th Amendment asked whether the people believed that risk of suicide was not sufficient for a case to justify abortion. And only 35% voted in favour. Effectively, the constitution was changed to allow that in cases of suicide, abortion would be permissible. The 13th Amendment would insert a line in the constitution saying that travel for an abortion couldn't be limited, and 62% voted in favour. And the 14th Amendment said that there couldn't be a limit to the right to distribute information about abortion services in foreign countries, and 60% voted in favour of that as well. The issue seemed to be settled for the time being, but on a weird, well, we're okay if abortion happens outside of Ireland, but not in Ireland. Because what this would bring about is effectively hundreds of thousands of women leaving Ireland to go and get abortions. Abortions were going to happen. Now, unfortunately, these are simply constitutional amendments. So these are the basis on which laws and regulations and legislation are drawn up. What the Irish government didn't do between 1992 and eventually in 2013 was actually put into law the specifics regarding when an abortion could happen, what the protections were for doctors, what the hospital regulations had to be, all the details that we generally don't think about. None of that had been enacted. And so we get to a second sad case. In October 2012, Savita Halappanavar, an Indian dentist who was living in Ireland, was admitted to hospital during the 17th week of her pregnancy, thanks to a miscarriage that had become inevitable. Halappanavar had requested an abortion. However, even after the last set of constitutional amendments, abortions that posed a risk to health were still illegal, and the doctors weren't convinced that there was a significant risk to life. Specifically, under the law that was enforced at the time, which is the Offences Against the Person Act of 1861, performing an abortion without the protection of the Eighth Amendment, i.e. there was a legitimate risk to life, risked a sentence of life imprisonment for doctors. An abortion was denied by the medical team because they were acting out of fear that there would be criminal repercussions on them, because there was no law specifically stating what they could and couldn't do in this particular situation. Unfortunately, during this time, due to the miscarriage, Savita ended up developing sepsis. And by the time the team had diagnosed her and begun treatment, it was too late. Savita died on October 28, 2012, due to cardiac arrest. Savita's death caused outrage nationally and internationally, leading to protests in Dublin, Galway and Cork, with Dublin's crowds reaching in excess of 12,000 people. Now, at the time, there was legal uncertainty regarding the precise circumstances a legal abortion could take place, and unfortunately, an abortion probably could have saved her life. This led to the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act 2013, when the Irish government finally laid out what abortion looked like under the Irish system. There was legislative clarity for doctors, it outlined specific cases in which an abortion could be performed, and under this legislation since 2013, only about 26 abortions have taken place per year.
So I can imagine that these laws are highly restrictive then.
Well, they have to be, because the Constitution has the final say. So as long as there is no risk to life of the mother, then an abortion can't happen. And obviously that is very restrictive. And this has caused significant problems that continue to occur today. So while there is a low abortion rate in Ireland, there are still many Irish women that still get abortions. There's the UK Abortion Act of 1967, which makes it relatively cheap and easy to travel to Great Britain for a legal abortion, because it's still illegal in Northern Ireland. Now, this peaked in 2001 above 6,000, but by 2016, that had dropped down to about 3,200 cases of women travelling across to the UK for an abortion. That's about 170,000 total since 1983. Now, unfortunately, the dip seems to be related to the use of unregulated abortion pills, which are bought online and shipped to Ireland. And after the events surrounding the death of Savita, the coming to light of the use of abortion pills, the coming to light of the number of women that are travelling to the UK for abortions, there's been increasing pressure on political parties to revisit the Eighth Amendment. And in fact, in the 2016 general election, the Labour Party, the Greens, Sinn Féin, effectively all the lefty parties, committed to a referendum on the repeal of the Eighth Amendment. Now, the two largest parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, are both centre-right, and they're historically largely against repeal. But last year, Leo Varadkar was elected leader of Fine Gael after Enda Kenny, his predecessor, stood down. And Varadkar is a more progressive individual. And so he had promised a referendum, and here we are today.
And so this referendum will remove the amendment that stated an abortion can only happen when there's concern for the life of the mother.
That's right. Specifically, it will be the entire Eighth Amendment text will be removed, including, well, strictly speaking, the 13th and the 14th amendments will be removed, and they'll be replaced by this line. Provision may be made by law for the regulation of termination of pregnancy, which effectively means the Oireachtas, the Parliament, can legislate on abortion. The Constitution is neutral on the matter if it passes.
So this amendment would put the ball in the court of the legislative branch, and then they can make the laws governing abortion?
That's right. It effectively yields the Constitution neutral in the issue and allows the Oireachtas to legislate however it wants. It's really important to know that what is being voted on today is the repeal of the Eighth Amendment and the replacement of it with that very short piece of text. What isn't strictly being voted on is the actual proposed law that the Irish government has said it will pass if a yes vote goes ahead. So maybe it's worth looking at that. Now, again, remember, this isn't strictly what's being voted on, but the Irish government proposes that a new Irish abortion law would be limited to 12 weeks, that a woman would have the right to seek a termination from a medical practitioner, but that that medical practitioner would have the legal obligation to discuss the woman's options with her before going ahead. If she still decides to go ahead, there's then a 3-day waiting period before the procedure can take place. Medical issues that pose a risk to the mother can result in termination with approval of two medical practitioners if that happens before week 24. But terminations can't be carried out after week 24. This is the week of viability. So effectively, a baby that has made it past 24 weeks is a viable contender for life, let's say. In an emergency, though, one doctor can approve but then must perform the procedure with no gestational limit, and that's if the mother is on the brink of death and the only thing that will save her is termination. And then terminations on mental health grounds effectively won't be changed because that is already allowed, even under the current constitutional setup, after suicide was particularly an allowable reason for a termination.
So even if the referendum passes and this legislation is put into effect, there will still be fairly stringent guidelines as to when abortions can happen and under which circumstances they can happen.
Well, that's right. It will still be one of the strictest abortion laws in Europe. The only two countries in Europe that currently don't allow abortions at all are Ireland and Malta. The 12-week limit actually brings it in line with most of the rest of the EU. Britain, interestingly, I didn't realise this, has a limit of 24 weeks, so it's actually got one of the more liberal abortion laws in the EU, but the difference with the British case is that you can't request a termination. It needs to be decided for you by a medical practitioner. Unfortunately, that has different loopholes that effectively yield it somewhat meaningless. We're not really here to talk about British abortion law. We're talking about Irish abortion law. But the fear is, on the no side in particular, that you know the Irish abortion law could effectively become more liberal or be interpreted in such a way as to make it as liberal as the British system. So there are legitimate concerns in the no side. In fact, what I wanted to do was run through the different reasons why each side wanted their particular resolution to happen. So for the yes side, they argued that, and quite rightly, that more than 170,000 women have travelled abroad for the procedure. So they argue that abortion still happens. So legalising it doesn't change anything. In fact, what it does is it allows Irish women to access good and free healthcare at home that's well regulated and is safe. They also say that the use of abortion pills, which is apparently 1,500 women per year, 2 or 3% of those cases end in medical complications, particularly in ectopic pregnancies. Now, unfortunately, these tend to go unreported because technically it's a criminal act, because you're putting a fetus at risk. There's fear of criminalisation. And by the way, these are statistics from Dr. Fergal Malone, who's the head of the Rotunda Hospital. So the yes side argue, well, why not give women the support that they need at home? And as I said earlier, it would bring Ireland into line with the rest of Europe anyway. One of their best arguments, though, is that the current wording in the Constitution doesn't allow for abortions in the case of rape, incest, and fatal fetal abnormalities. These are pregnancies that pose significant risk, if not life-threatening risk, to the mother. As I've been listening to some of the coverage of the campaign, this seems to be something that the majority of Irish people tend to agree with anyway, whether they're on the no or the yes side, is that in the case of rape, incest, and fatal fetal abnormality, abortion termination should be allowed. But in order for that to happen in Ireland, you have to repeal the Eighth Amendment. The No side, on the other hand, as you would expect, they say that the life of the child is a life. It has as equal right to life as any other living thing. They argue that the legislation of abortion will lead to the same rates of abortion as in the UK, which apparently is about 20% of pregnancies. Now, the rates are probably lower than 20%, given that they don't calculate miscarriage rates in the UK. But nonetheless, in 2016, 200,000 terminations were carried out in the UK. That's a significant number that has garnered a lot of attention in Ireland.
Especially for a population that's only about 60 million.
Yeah, that's right. And the fact that it is calculated when it's live birth, stillbirth, and terminations, it is a full 21% in the UK that end in terminations. It's a massive, massive number. That really caught me off guard, actually, as to how big that was. But the best argument on the No side is that there's a fear that over time abortion laws could be further liberalised beyond the initial 12 weeks. So remember, the Constitution will give power to the Oireachtas to legislate as it sees fit. So who's to say that an Oireachtas, a body, a government, further down the road doesn't further liberalise? So that is a decent point, actually, because what the Yes side seems to be campaigning on is that, oh, don't worry, it'll just be 12 weeks. It won't be any worse than any other European country. But, you know, in actual fact, to take something like this out of the Constitution means that you give license to future governments to liberalise the law further, to loosen the law further.
Right, that makes sense. There'll be no constitutional limitations whatsoever.
Effectively, yeah, that's absolutely right. So the campaign has apparently been well-mannered, largely, at least on the ground. The internet, of course, is the internet. So there's also a few interesting threads in the campaign process that I thought were really interesting. Google and Facebook, for instance, banned ads from foreign interest groups, which, surprise, surprise, were mostly in the States, which has caused a secondary debate on campaign law in Ireland, which, of course, at the moment heavily regulates TV and to a lesser extent papers, but doesn't do anything about the internet. So it allowed pro and anti-abortion groups in the States to just funnel huge amounts of money into advertising on Google and Facebook.
And what has been the effect of these campaigns? Have we seen any sizable shifts in the polling going into this referendum?
Yeah, so at the beginning, there was a massive poll lead for the Yes side. Now, apparently this happens quite a lot in Irish referendum polling, in which one side just tends to be skyrocketed ahead of the other. But over time, that gap has slowly narrowed. Now, the expectation was that Yes would still win this. And I think after this week in which they've had televised debates on the issue, there's been no big spark for the No side. So what the No side really needed this week in particular was something to spark the campaign that would bring down the Yes side, that would undo their arguments. And that just hasn't happened. So momentum will stay with the Yes side as they head into the referendum today.
So you think ultimately the Yes side is going to win?
I mean, if you were to trust polling, but we know what polling has done in the past, and I think the general consensus is that the Yes side will likely win, but it's close enough possibly to almost be within the margin of error for the No side to just eke it out. The referendum has also inspired a new hashtag, #HomeToVote. As Irish expats on both sides of the issue have begun flying home to vote, Ireland, particularly for its referenda, doesn't allow postal voting. And so you see folks from Hanoi, Bangkok, Los Angeles, Tokyo, Buenos Aires, Prince Edward Island in Canada, all flying back to the homeland to vote in this particular referendum. The same thing happened in 2015 for the same-sex marriage referendum. Now, this is actually really interesting. In my first trimester of my program here, I wrote a paper on turnout rates for Irish referenda. And of course, it's these big controversial issues that end up having the most pull for people. And for people living abroad, even, it has enough pull for them to fly back from these, you know, very exotic places around the world. So 3.2 million people are registered to vote. And ultimately, it will be left to the Irish people today to figure out whether they want to have abortion legalized or not.
All right. So we've covered the context of abortion in Ireland. We've talked about specific cases which brought this into the public consciousness, and we've covered the actual referendum and what's likely to happen afterwards. But obviously a big part of this podcast is us sharing our opinion and having a discussion about this. So are you emotionally prepared to tackle this subject, Adam?
Yes, I think so. I don't tend to, well, let's say I tend to view things objectively. We'll see what happens.
That's the thing, though. It's really hard to view this issue objectively. I mean, speaking to this from the American context, this is such a divisive issue. I very rarely, if ever, seen an objective discussion about this, where both sides come to the table civilly and have an actual conversation. instead of just speaking of the other side as not only wrong, but immoral?
Well, let's set the precedent, or at least try, because I think my views in particular tend towards the center on the issue. So I'd be intrigued to see how much you... In fact, we might actually end up agreeing quite a bit on this.
I'd like to think that my view is more centrist on the topic. I come from a fairly conservative upbringing, and I've always struggled with this issue because from my point of view for a long period of time, most of my life, it's been framed as moral versus immoral. And the personal aspect of this, the personal stories that you talked about that brought this issue to the foreground in Ireland, things like that, were never the focus. It was more of a high-level narrative versus narrative that, like I said, vilified the other side. And so it's been really difficult for me in my own life to find the middle ground between those two. And I think what's happened, that you, at least in the context of the United States, you'll see almost a false dichotomy where if you are morally against something, you then by default have to be politically against it as well.
Mm.
Whereas I don't think that's necessarily the case. So trying to find that middle ground for me has been difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just start with my personal feelings. I think that the prospect of abortion, and I know I speak as a man here in this situation, so I will never experience in the same way that a woman would have to experience this decision, I do view it as morally dubious. And I've struggled with this a lot, especially since I've had my own children. I can't imagine having had my wife make that decision. But at the same time, when I really reflect on this and dig deeper into my own position, if my wife were to get pregnant again and we were to come into a situation where her life was threatened by a third pregnancy, and I think I can honestly say that I don't know what I would do. I know how much I love my wife. I know how important she is to our two children. To weigh that consideration, my love for my wife, her life, the well-being of my other two children, to weigh those considerations against the life of an unborn baby, even if it was my own, would be nearly impossible. And so that's just my personal feelings on the situation. And I think it's important to dive into that because I think it's important to understand what it would be like to be in somebody else's shoes. Until you've imagined yourself in that situation, and until you really come to terms with the decision that you would make, I think it's incredibly hard to address it politically, because it's easy to look at that and say, well, I would never do that, and I believe it's immoral, so it should be illegal. I think what you'll find is when you're put into a situation like that, so often what you believe to be morally right or wrong kind of goes out the window, and you have to really face these incredibly difficult decisions. Do I think that abortion should be used as a form of birth control? Absolutely not. But I do think that so much of the time, both sides just ignore the personal aspect of it. So I think it's important when you talk about this to really consider how you yourself would act in that situation.
That's a really good point. I think we have a tendency to get caught up in the big moral arguments, the big institutional legal arguments, rights arguments, without actually considering the person that has to go through the decision, because I'm sure there are plenty of women who have gone through an abortion and have regretted it. There have been plenty of women that have gone through and have never regretted it. Point being is that there is an individual element that easily gets lost. And I think is a very good point. And I think there's a certain amount of compassion that we miss when we talk about this particular issue. And fair enough, it's incredibly divisive because it literally deals with life and liberty, the balance of those two rights. And particularly within the American case, you know, how do you balance life and liberty? You know, when the Constitution, when the historical philosophy guarantees both. So it's, I understand, it's just such a difficult thing. My own perspective, if we can jump to mine. So I tend to come from I am a Christian, so my ethics are based within my faith. So human life is precious in all its forms. So I hate the death penalty. I hate war. I hate abortion as well. And I think there's a tendency within political systems, particularly democratic-like systems, that those with power, that those with the voice, will always overlook those without the voice. This has been true in the past. Like, wherever there's been a set of people making decisions for other people, they've always taken their own self-interest in mind. And now that we have near universal suffrage, the category of human that is left out is the unborn life. They are the ones that are set aside. They're the ones that can be sacrificed for our liberty. But that being said, I hate regulation and government that impedes on the individual, and particularly specifically on the body. I think it is an unconscionable, immoral thing in itself for a government to be able to determine and regulate the body of an individual. that the only way that I've really figured how to balance this in my head, these two things, is I think it was Clinton that said abortion should be legal but unnecessary. And so I have a challenge to both sides, to pro-choicers and pro-lifers. So if you're a pro-choice person, consider that the arguments that you have are literally minimizing human life. I want to challenge you on the value that you have for human life generally, because it's very easy to value the life that we can see and to ignore or put to the side the life that we can't see. I'm very uncomfortable with the direction that we're taking as a society in terms of the value of human life. And that is also included in abortion is also things like euthanasia. It's that value of human life, because it is a precious thing. There's few things like it as far as we know in the universe, but certainly in our world. And my challenge to pro-lifers, for you, I have a lot to say to you because I grew up amongst you, is put your money where your mouth is. Fund programs that support single mothers. Fund adoption networks. Fund orphanages. Foster and adopt yourselves. It's very easy to sit back in our comfortable life and to minimize or to create a black and white, right and wrong category for what people are going through. There are women who are making very, very difficult choices. If you're a pro-lifer, you should be in the position not only to reach out to that person to help, but also to help if they decide to have the child, which means that, well, you support a welfare system for orphans and single mothers. That is very difficult for the right, particularly in America, to hear. Would you open up your own family to potential abortion kids and adopt them and foster them? Create relationships with women who are seriously considering an abortion and saying, no, we can take care of your kid for you. That is a huge and massive commitment that we're not seeing enough of.
I think I would have the same critique for the left. Having grown up as a pro-lifer, it's very difficult for me now to separate that in my head and to accept the willingness of certain individuals or even society as a whole to minimize the life of an unborn fetus. For the right wing, similar to what you said, we're putting your money where your mouth is, I don't think that it's viable to only talk about abortion in emotional terms. I don't think it's viable not to have pragmatic solutions to the problem. And a lot of times that's going to force you to act against what you think is right in order to obtain your goals. So I think across the political spectrum, the goal should be to limit the number of abortions. My suggestion for the right is to focus less on banning abortion completely and focus more on limiting the number that do happen, because abortion is legal in the United States. It's legal constitutionally. It's legal across the world in many different places. It's not something that's just going to go away. And this is specifically for the right wing in America. It's like they want to have their cake and eat it too. They want abortion to be illegal, and they also at the same time want to limit sex education, for instance. So many states in the United States focus solely on abstinence only, and I think that's a huge mistake. There's been plenty of studies around this, and the states that focus on abstinence only education have a negative correlation between the level of sex education and the number of teen pregnancies and abortions that happen within those states. So you have a 40% rate of teen pregnancies in the United States, whereas in countries like Germany, in, you know, Italy, France, that rate is less than 20%. The places that have more comprehensive sex education, that have more comprehensive, you know, and even universal access to birth control, those states have lower levels of abortions, lower levels of STDs, lower levels of teen pregnancy than in the United States, where we're focusing on abstinence only. And yes, you might see promiscuous sex as a moral evil. But again, I think that sometimes you have to be politically for things that you're morally against to achieve a higher goal. So if the goal is to limit abortions, which I think is an admirable goal, I don't think anybody on either side of the debate lauds abortion or thinks it's a good thing, right? You might have some outliers on the extreme left that think it's a good thing. I don't think that that's the majority. If you want to limit the abortions, the most effective and pragmatic and up until now successful way to do that has been a focus on sex education, a focus on contraception being available, and just open, honest conversations about sex and reproductive rights. Where you've seen that happen, you've seen lower rates of abortion, obviously, except for what we were talking about, the UK. I don't know why the UK's rates are so high, but in other countries, you're seeing that they're much lower rates than the United States. So I think it's a big challenge to both sides, because both sides have to learn how to compromise, and both sides have to learn how to listen to the other side. You know, I don't think that there should be an unlimited, completely unregulated right to abortion, but I also don't think that it's feasible to expect to be able to ban abortion completely and then also at the same time push for these conservative policies when it comes to sex education and access to reproductive care and contraception. I think that it has to be a mix of the two. I agree with the goal of limiting abortions. I think everybody would. But you got to find the best pragmatic way to do so. Because right now, both sides are just spinning their wheels and nobody's making any headway.
I think we'll end the discussion there. I think John and I didn't necessarily have a lot of fun, but we found it very worthwhile to go through these debates again. And John, thanks for being honest about your views, and hopefully I was as honest with mine as well. So because of the particular controversial nature of this topic, if you disagreed with us at any point, you know, feel free to email us. There may certainly have been points where the mind had switched off and the mouth kept running. That's because it's 1 o'clock in the morning, my time. So if you have any comments or questions or concerns, we have a contact form on our website. We'd be happy to get back to you.
We read everything. So if you do have any feedback on this episode whatsoever, if you're uncomfortable with anything that we said, or you disagree or agree with us, let us know. Whew, that was difficult. Now we take a look at some news stories you should be paying attention to in this next week.
So one of the things I have for you to check out has actually already happened today, if you're listening on Friday. The Scottish Government has released a long-awaited Growth Commission report outlining the policies necessary to make an independent Scotland a successful and viable country. The Growth Commission studied 14 small countries and have compiled a list of policy suggestions that a small country like Scotland should take if it were to become economically successful. Rumours are already swirling about what it will contain. Should Scotland emulate Finland or New Zealand? Will it propose the creation of a new Scottish currency? How much extra monies will we have? £4,000 a year, apparently, is the rumour. The release of the Commission report is the first step to reopening the independence debate, which may lead to a second independence referendum sometime in the next few years. But that depends on what Brexit looks like and who the hell knows what's going on there.
In the United States, it appears that Paul Ryan is losing some of his grip on the GOP conference in the House of Representatives. While embroiled in party infighting over DACA and border security, the Freedom Caucus, surprise, surprise, withheld their votes from a farm bill, which is one of the GOP's legislative priorities for the year. Other representatives have also signaled that they will sign a petition to force a vote on DACA ahead of the 2018 midterms, which is a move that Paul Ryan has advocated against. Ryan announced his retirement from Congress earlier this year, and as of right now, there doesn't seem to be a viable replacement for him to lead the party into the 2018 midterms. These rifts in the party could open the door for big losses at the polls while the GOP struggles to identify and unify behind a consistent vision. So it's something to keep an eye on.
Today also, a massive new European law called the General Data Protection Regulation comes into effect. It applies to EU citizens and not just within EU territory. So that means that US and Chinese firms and corporations need to follow this law as well. It's designed for the big social networks or any data gathering corporation. And it comes with a few nifty regulations that these corporations have to follow. So one, it has to get your explicit consent before it gathers your data. It needs to do so in a clearly distinguished way. It can't hide it in a long terms and conditions pamphlet. Pre-ticked boxes aren't allowed anymore, and these corporations can't ask for extra data for extra access. That's now illegal. If you're a European citizen, you now have the right of access and the erasure of your data, and you can ask for a copy of all your data, including for that company to delete it. You're protected from theft, and the corporations must report that theft. And if they don't, these corporations can now be subject to a 20 million euro fine, or 4% of their global turnover, whatever is larger. That's one of the great things about being European.
Moving to South America, on Sunday this week, Colombians will head to the polls for a presidential election. What's so interesting about this election is that the candidate currently polling in second place, Gustavo Petro, is a former leftist guerrilla fighter. Although he is unlikely to win on Sunday or in any runoff elections, polls indicate that he is close to within 10 points of the leading candidate, Ivan Duque. Petro was a member of the guerrilla group M19 in the 1980s, but has transformed himself into a politician. His supporters hope that he'll be able to build upon a recent peace deal between the Colombian government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. The wide support for Petro could signal a resurgence of the left in Colombia, which has traditionally only existed in a guerrilla opposition form. We'll have to see. And that's all we have time for today. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Absurdistanis. We're also on YouTube as Absurdistan with an exclamation point. Be sure to check out our website, absurdistanis.com. That's absurdistanis.com. We post all episodes to this website and post forums for discussion so that you as the audience can engage with our content. Thanks again for listening, and as always, stay informed.